Think is made possible in part by Guaranty Bank, using its more than 100 years of business experience to provide financing for small and medium-sized businesses and independent oil and gas producers throughout Texas. By Perot Systems, a technology services company trusted by more than 500 clients worldwide. Perot Systems delivers technology infrastructure services, consulting, application solutions, and business process solutions that enable growth. By Southwest Securities, a nationally recognized regional brokerage firm that's been meeting the needs of Southwest investors for more than 30 years. Southwest Securities is a member of the New York Stock Exchange and SIPC. And by the Executive Education Center at the University of Texas at Dallas, providing degree and non-degree programs to help corporate professionals and executives stay ahead. On the web at som.utdallas.edu/executive.
Welcome to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. It is conventional wisdom that voters are best served by highly competitive general elections. But what if voters were actually better off in districts specifically and openly drawn to favor one party or the other? Thomas Brunell is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Texas at Dallas. In his new book, Redistricting and Representation, Why Competitive Elections Are Bad for America, he takes a contrarian view of the electoral conditions that satisfy voters, and he is here now to talk about it. Tom, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me.
So you started by looking at what makes voters happy with their elected representatives. What did you find?
That's right. It's a straightforward dichotomy that when voters who win the election, whose preferred candidate wins, they're much more satisfied, not surprisingly, with the outcome than losers are. And it really, the idea for the book, I was struck after the 2004 election, after the presidential election, after George Bush was reelected. I was listening to NPR, and they had a show where they were talking to a clinical psychologist, and he was talking about, this was just days after the election, about how people were, like, clinically depressed, Democrats, because of the election outcome. And there was, you know, rumors of immigration lawyers in San Francisco selling out seminars to immigrate, for Americans to immigrate to Canada because they were so upset and all this sort of stuff. So the competitiveness of the election doesn't really matter. Voters want to win, right? Just like in anything else, voters want to win, and they want to see their preferred policies be put into effect by the government.
But there's been no statistically significant increase in Americans immigrating to Canada, right? Isn't this just temporary?
Yes, and that's the thing. I mean, I don't think there was any huge fallout. You know, I think it was just in the weeks after the election, you know, Alec Baldwin threatened to move, and I don't think he moved anywhere. And so I really don't think a lot of people left, but they were clearly upset by the outcome. And there are these things, you know, there's companies selling like countdown clocks for when the president leaves office and stuff like that. So I think there's some lingering, unsatisfaction with the outcome. But we're about to be able to have a new election, and so then we could redo everything all over again.
So we have a history in Texas of dividing up districts according to one party's advantage or the other, but technically that's not the way it's supposed to go. You think, on the other hand, that maybe is the right way to do things.
Absolutely. I draw an analogy to something like if I were asked to draw districts in Rwanda, you know, would I draw a district with half Hutus and half Tutsis? Or, you know, if you went to Iraq, you wouldn't say, hey, let's draw a district and we'll put 50% Sunnis and 50% Shiites in it. It just doesn't make any sense. And in the same way, drawing districts here in America that are half Democratic and half Republican, I don't think makes any sense either. You know, all the benefits that we think competitive elections deliver are really not really there. And so let's maximize the number of people that are satisfied with the outcome and that get well represented in Congress. That's my argument.
So what this would do is basically throw the real competition into the primary contest. And why do you think that's better for voters?
I think it's better. America is somewhat unique. There are many countries now that have primary elections, but we were the first. And since we have two shots at electing our representatives, there's no reason to have them both be competitive, right? There's really no reason to have two ultra-competitive elections. So, like I said before, if we have competitive general elections, that means that a lot of voters are going to end up unsatisfied with the outcome. So, but if we draw a district that was, say, hypothetically 100% Democratic, right, they're all going to be happy with the general election outcome because we know a Democrat is going to win. But in the primary election, it still can be very competitive. We could have 2, 3, 4, maybe more Democrats vying for the nomination. And that's going to be the real, that's where the competition ought to happen. So I'm not against competition in elections altogether. It's just really moving the locus of the competition from the general election to the primary, where people, where like-minded people can kind of battle it out and pick the best candidate for all of them.
I sense a danger when the government's deciding where like-minded people reside. Do you worry about that?
Well, I mean, it's and again, you couldn't really, you'd have to draw really funny-looking districts to get even maybe 90% Democratic or 90% Republican. And I'm all in favor of it. You know, I think it, the district can look as funny as it has to be. And I mean, I don't think it really poses any danger because we're a very mobile society and we redraw the districts every 10 years. And they are artificial, right? We don't really see where the district lines are when we're driving across town. And so I really see lots and lots of benefits from doing it this way. And I think the costs are very low.
So we're a mobile society. Do you think this could affect the patterns of where people move? You know, would you decide, I'm not going to live on that side of town because it's full of Democrats or it's full of Republicans?
We don't have any evidence of that. I suspect that, you know, at the margins, maybe that comes into play for some people, but obviously it's not the most important thing. I know that, you know, when me and my wife have moved several times across the country and in Texas, we've never thought, well, who's our representative here? But there was a couple years ago, a group of libertarians kind of they got together and voted on where they should all move. This was like 2,000 or 3,000 people, and they thought New Hampshire was the best place. And I think literally a few thousand people decided purposefully to move to New Hampshire because the politics suited them the best there.
Well, that leads to an interesting question, which is, does this effectively negate the possibility that a strong third-party candidate can get into Congress?
It would make it very difficult. There's no doubt about it. And so I like to say that, you know, the chances are remote now, and they'd be a little more remote if we went to something like this, to be sure. But again, most people are either Democratic or Republican, and it wouldn't prevent a third party from gaining lots and lots of voters. And once they got to sort of a threshold, then they could sort of overtake one of the other two parties. And so they still could emerge, but this isn't friendly to electing Greens or Libertarians to Congress, that's for sure.
What about the question of voter apathy? Because I have to wonder, if you live in District A and it's 90% Republican and that's the way you vote, then you say, well, there's this hot primary contest, but I don't really care because no matter what, a Republican's going to be in. And so people actually turn off to the election itself.
I don't think that would happen, honestly. And the general election, we have the general election where I think people are still going to vote because, again, we're talking about congressional elections and state legislative elections, and people usually turn out for those elections to vote for the president and senators and governors. So I don't think it really affect turnout that much at the general election. And so at the primary, I think, while they could become apathetic, I don't think they would. And so the best example is the current Democratic primary at the presidential level. I mean, people are really, you know, excited and worked up about, you know, the choice between Hillary and Obama, and so I think we could kind of replicate that, you know, at lower, more local levels for congressional districts as well. And so quite the contrary, I think it could stimulate interest and participation.
But we know that people always pay more attention to presidential elections than to those that are more local. There's more money to be spent. How does spending on elections change in this scenario?
Oh, that's a good question. It would obviously the general election would be pretty boring sort of thing, right? And so there wouldn't be much spending on that. But there could be a lot more spending at the primary level. I mean, it's, you know, again, I'm speculating, but I think there would be some very, very competitive primary elections and some not so much. I mean, at the moment, primary elections are fairly uncompetitive across the country. But again, this could stimulate interest. Would it stimulate interest in every single congressional district? No, almost certainly not. But I think it really could because I kind of think of a primary election as like you're kind of fine-tuning your representation, right? I'm choosing between a Republican that's right here and one that's right here, or a Democrat that's, you know, just to the left of me or just to the right of me, rather than, you know, two stark choices between a Democrat or Republican, and I might be much closer to one than the other.
Of course, all of this makes the assumption that there are always stark differences between Democrats and Republicans.
Right.
And I'm wondering if you're just capitulating to the idea that it will always be a really polarized political scene.
Right. I mean, I don't think, no. I mean, the short answer is I don't think that I am. And some people are worried that this would add to an already polarized Washington, D.C., that there are differences between the two parties, and they do seem to be, you know, at each other's throats a little bit more. And I don't really think that it would, because, I mean, you're still going to have local differences. You know, if we draw a district that's 80% Republican in Texas, that's going to be a very different that's going to elect a very different Republican than if we draw an 80% district in Maine. That still could elect a Republican. And so it still allows for differences across the country. And I don't think that there's no evidence that these overwhelmingly safe districts at the general election contribute to more polarized members of Congress either. That's another worry that people talk about when they criticize the idea that I have here, is that you know, if you don't have to worry about the general election and you don't have to worry about the moderates, you're just going to be, you know, super conservative or really liberal, and that's not the case. There's no evidence to suggest that would happen.
How do you get around the problem that you effectively disenfranchise the people who happen to be unlucky enough to be that 10 or 20% minority in their district?
Right. Yeah, it's a tough one. And I get hit on this all the time. And I think it's a little bit ironic because, you know, I'm trying to take districts that are, say, 60-40. And so 40% of the people are losers. And so I'm saying, well, let's minimize the number of losers down to, say, you know, 20 or 10%. And so then people say, well, what about those poor 20% of those poor people? It's like, well, I'm trying to get rid of as many losers as I can. And you can't get rid of all of them, unfortunately. And it wouldn't be fun, right? I mean, that's the whole point of my argument, is that losers aren't happy. And so if you're in a district that was literally, you're part of a 10% minority, you really have no chance of electing anybody in the general election. But congressional district lines do change every 10 years. So there's a chance, you know, demographics change, that eventually maybe your district becomes a majority that you share the ideas with, right? That maybe you're a Democrat in a heavily Republican Texas, but in 10 or 20 years, the demography changes and maybe the area that you live in becomes more Democratic, and then you win.
Is being happy with one's representative critical to having good government?
I think the happiness, I mean, I think it is important. It because when you win, this also is related to trust in government and how well they evaluate Congress as an institution. So winners are more happier with their representative, but they are also happier with Congress as an institution. So I think this could help. And Congress historically has been, you know, has very, very low approval rates. So I think this would help somewhat. And again, this is about representation. And so my ideal district is about 650,000 people. So my ideal district is me and 650,000 people that think exactly like me, right? And then we could pick any one of us, could go to Washington, D.C., and they would represent our views perfectly, right? And so it's not just about being happy, but it's about being well represented. And so homogeneous districts allow for representation to be more accurate, and it allows it to be easier, right? I mean, if we draw a competitive district, and half the people want higher taxes and half the people want lower taxes, half the people are pro-choice and half the people are pro-life, and you throw some poor representative in there and say, you know, represent these people's views, it's impossible. And again, this is another reason for the argument that competitive, it's impossible to be responsive to a district where half the district thinks X and half it thinks not X.
But what happens for the people who are pro-choice and anti-gun control?
Right.
There are many people who are not perfectly defined, I think to a greater extent perhaps even than party politicians, who are not perfectly defined by party platforms.
Right. And again, there I go back to the sort of the local differences can have that effect. And because I think you'd find people like that, like in Pennsylvania, maybe not so much in Texas. But there's no doubt there are lots of people that aren't, that they can't fit themselves really well into one of the two parties. And we could switch to a completely different kind of system, like maybe proportional representation, that would allow for more smaller parties to develop, where we would increase how well people are represented even further. But working within the single-member district system that we have, I'm trying to sort of mimic that as best I can. But again, you can't fix every problem.
Call this my media bias, but there's a strong argument to be made that a healthy distrust in what Congress is doing is good for the way this country is run.
Right. Yeah, no, I think there's some truth to that. And it's not like this is going to be, you know, the clouds are going to part and everybody's going to be, you know, jumping around happy. And so I think there will still be that distrust. I think Americans kind of fundamentally distrust people. Even if you have a representative that shares a lot of your views, you still are going to be somewhat distrustful of what's going on in Washington, especially, right? So I think maybe we'd have a little bit more happiness and trust with our representative, that one-on-one relationship we have with the government. But more broadly, we're always going to be suspicious of what they're doing in Washington.
This is such a diversion from what most people believe about the nature of our government and what's healthy, that there are some people who have assumed that this was satire, that you weren't even serious about this.
Yes.
Is this a thought exercise for you, or is this something that you actually hope that people will take and act upon?
Right. That's a good question. And I tell the story in the book that the first time I sent this out as an article, I wrote a shorter version of the book. And the blind reviewer didn't know that I wrote it. That's the blind part about it. Said that this has to be a joke. You know, this person cannot be serious that they want to have less competitive elections. But no, it's a I do believe in it, and I think that there's I think that it's a very good argument, and I think that I'm right. Now, do I think that it's going to happen? You know, across the country, probably not. So in some sense, I'm an academic, so I won't say it's completely an academic exercise. I would love to see people take it up and take some of it to heart and have it put into public policy. But you know, I'm not gonna hold my breath waiting for it to happen either.
Well, that's a really interesting position, Tom. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks, Chris.
You can read Thomas Brunell's new book. It's called Redistricting and Representation, Why Competitive Elections Are Bad for America. Just ahead on Think, Blue Bonnets and Beyond. The Dallas Museum of Art showcases American Impressionist Julian Onderdonk. First, take a look at this week's arts calendar.
The Art and Seat calendar for this weekend includes Onstage Obsessions, Visions of New Mexico, and Art in the City. The Dallas Arts District plays host to the 5th Annual City Arts Celebration, a weekend of visual, performing, and culinary arts, kid-friendly activities, and free admission to the DMA Nasher & Crowe Collection. Opening at UT Dallas' Central Track Residency, check out Echo, a collection of narrative and non-narrative video, curated by Mary Benedicto and featuring an outdoor installation by Jeannie Casanova. On stage at the Rosemarine Theater in Fort Worth, the Butterfly Connection makes their mighty return with the multimedia satire The Boxer and the Blonde, an exploration of the dreams and obsessions of an aspiring champ and his actress girlfriend, with a live score from The Morning People. And at the Amon Carter, see New Mexico through new eyes in their brand new show, Marsden Hartley in the West, The Search for an American Modernism, that's opening on Sunday. For more about these events, join us at artandseek.org, the new website for the arts in North Texas. For Art and Seek, I'm Jeannie Mascoro.
Just as the season for Texas Blue Bonnets is brilliant but all too brief, so were the life and career of the artist celebrated for capturing them. The Dallas Museum of Art is hosting an exhibition through July 20th called Blue Bonnets and Beyond, Julian Onderdonk, American Impressionist. And William Keyes Rudolph, who is the Pauline Gill Sullivan Associate Curator of American Art at the DMA, joins us to talk about what the show contains. William, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Even within Onderdonk's lifetime, there were sort of hack artists painting these uninspired pictures of blue bonnets. What made his so extraordinary?
Well, first of all, they're beautiful. And Julian had better training than anyone else working in Texas at the time, with the exception of his father. And that's one of the hooks of our exhibition, is that Julian Onderdonk was the son of Robert Jenkins Onderdonk, a very important early Texas artist who had immigrated to Texas in 1879 after studying in New York with William Merritt Chase, who was a leading artist of the day, radical young man back in the 1870s. And so Robert studied with Chase and brought that sort of instruction to San Antonio and Dallas. And his son went back at 19 to study with Chase. So automatically it put him in a league that other artists working in Texas just weren't in. And so he wasn't the person who invented the blue bonnet, but he was the person who did it the best, and no one's ever, and we've seen lots of examples of it since his day, no one's ever done it the way he did it. And we also hope that when our visitors come and see the show, that we might gently suggest that the blue bonnets were not just pretty for Julian, but that they also carried a lot of ideological weight and had a particular artistic mission.
Mm-hmm. And he liked to paint in particular conditions. He didn't like to be shut up inside a studio. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Well, Julian loved nature. And when he is an art student in 1901, at 18 on the cusp of 19, he is writing home to his parents about how much he misses Texas. He doesn't really like being stuck in the studio. He's traumatized by the anatomy class. And so when he has the chance to go study with Chase at the Shinnecock Summer School in Southampton, he writes, he's so ecstatic, and we have a vinyl quote that tells you all about this. I just can't wait to get out into the landscape and smear paint over the whole landscape. And of course, that was what Chase advocated. Go out and work right from nature, take your little easel out on the dunes and paint. And Julian did that throughout his career. He worked outside in all weathers, both in and around New York when he was there and when he came back to Texas as well. And of course, then you're in the studio and you work up smaller sketches into big finished pictures. You can't really sit outside with a big 30 by 40 piece of canvas or you'll drive yourself crazy. But working directly from nature and being outside and empirically viewing things was totally fundamental to Julian's work.
In addition to the work that he was producing, he also had influence on art and tastes in Texas because he was there at the State Fair. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Again, it's the father-son act. And Robert Jenkins Onderdonk had been retained by the Texas State Fair Association to select works of art for the State Fair, which he did, and then Julian began to assist him in about 1906 and took it over after Robert's death. Now, today we go to the State Fair, and I love the fair, and I love to go there sort of for, you know, look through your fingers in horror at, like, googly-eyed dog pillows and butter sculptures.
Elvis.
Yeah, the things we love to sort of go, oh, my, this is art. But back in the day, in the early 20th century, the State Fair had a really reputable art program. It was very serious, and Julian and Robert basically acted as curators and did lots of studio visits in New York, selected the best in contemporary art, and brought it to Texas for display. And what's particularly important for the Dallas Museum of Art is that most of those works, a lot of the works that were selected then, were either bought by our parent organization for the new museum, or bought by collectors who eventually gave them to the museum. So when you look at our American painting collection in the first 20 years of our history, and we were founded in 1903, virtually every American painting that entered our collection was in some ways touched by the hand of Julian Onderdonk, because he selected it and to have it brought here for exhibition. So we've been invested in him since the beginning. He was one of the first paintings we bought, and he was, 21 or 22 at the time, but also he had a much more subtle influence. So we're really happy to be able to celebrate that 105-year connection with him at this point.
What sort of works was he drawn to?
Well, he liked contemporary American landscape because he was a landscape artist, both urban and rural, and he was conservative in the sense that he did not select abstraction, but then in all fairness, that wasn't popular taste in the early 20th century. We're sort of misled by the idea of the Armory Show in 1913, and that suddenly everybody looked like something abstract and something that led inexorably to abstract expressionism. That actually wasn't the case. So Julian liked very pleasing and painterly American landscape, and we have wound up with quite a wonderful collection of that we're only starting to realize, I think, how wonderful our own examples of it are, because quite frankly a lot of them lived in the basement for a long time, and now we have people come through, scholars and dealers, and they look at these and say, if you ever want to, which we wouldn't, but if you ever want to part with that, that's an extraordinary example by fill in the blank. So Julian actually wound up having very prescient taste.
What sorts of things did he react to? In other words, other people were sort of copying his work. Can you talk about how he bristled at that?
Well, Julian was called the bluebonnet painter, and it was something that he hated because it was a little too facile. And I really think, I have to believe, that for Julian, the bluebonnets were actually an artistic challenge that allowed him to really synthesize the view of nature that he had empirically and the way he'd been trained to look at nature by William Merritt Chase. So in other words, when you're working from nature and you're out there and you're painting directly what you see, bluebonnets are rather spectacular as a challenge because they're ephemeral, they're brief, they seem very sort of beautiful and simple, yet in point of fact they're quite varied. And so you're setting yourself this challenge of trying to capture what is fleeting and what changes from year to year and season to season. And so for him, I think it was a way of exploring what it is to be a landscape painter with this material that had great personal significance because he was from Texas, he loved his landscape, but also it satisfied, I think, some intellectual abilities. And quite frankly, when you look at other bluebonnet paintings, even in his own day and particularly since, it's not the same thing. People are going for the color and the beauty, but there's no depth and there's no teeth or legs.
And you've got all the blue bonnets in one room. Must be extraordinary.
24 blue bonnets in one room. It is my sort of Texas love letter to the Orangerie or the Musée Marmottan. I've been jokingly calling them, but actually not so jokingly, Julian's water lilies. Because like the way that Monet and the Impressionists explored a particular subject over and over and over again, just to reveal how changeable and how fascinatingly different the same thing can be at different times of day, different times of year, from different angles. Julian's doing the same thing with the blue bonnets.
Can't wait to see it. Thank you so much for coming, William.
Great. Thank you.
You can see the exhibition Blue Bonnets and Beyond, Julian Onderdonk, American Impressionist, at the DMA through July 20th. For free video and audio podcast, you can go to kera.org/think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for being with us, and have a great week.
Think is made possible in part by Guaranty Bank, using its more than 100 years of business experience to provide financing for small and medium-sized businesses and independent oil and gas producers throughout Texas. By Perot Systems, a technology services company trusted by more than 500 clients worldwide. Perot Systems delivers technology infrastructure services, consulting, application solutions, and business process solutions that enable growth. By Southwest Securities, a nationally recognized regional brokerage firm that's been meeting the needs of Southwest investors for more than 30 years. Southwest Securities is a member of the New York Stock Exchange and SIPC. And by the Executive Education Center at the University of Texas at Dallas, providing degree and non-degree programs to help corporate professionals and executives stay ahead. On the web at som.utdallas.edu/executive. We'll be right back.